WORAM and FM, New York.
It's 10:15 in New York, and this is Martha Dean, and good morning, everybody. And I won't tell you anything about our distinguished guest for, two or three minutes, because she has just taken quite a drive through traffic, and it wasn't easy to find a place to park, and she needs a second breakfast, and I propose to leave her alone over there on the other side of the table and let her have some good hot coffee, and there's some food coming up to go with it. And I will talk to you about a couple of things before I tell you about her. This is what is known as getting into the program with the Nellie is hanging over the edge of the cliff, and will be continued in our next technique, isn't it? Anyway, we do have a fine guest this morning, an old friend of yours and mine, and a woman we all admire. And I will, as I say, do a couple of things while she's having a little breakfast. Now about our guest. She's Margaret Burkwhite. Good morning.
Good morning.
You getting along all right now?
Fine. Coffee was hot and good. I feel as though I'm living again.
I appreciate your getting up early and leaving the country and driving down this morning, because it must have been much nicer in the country than it is in the city today.
Yes, but you're such a nice girl yourself that I can sacrifice the dawn for you. Real sacrifice, but still.
Thank you very much.
It's a measurement of my esteem.
Thank you. How is everything up in the country?
Well, it's wonderful. I have my pool still, and the place looks a little wild in a way, because I decided I needed a new lawn.
Ooh.
So for the last couple of days, it's looked like one of my own industrial photographs, you know, great earth movers all over the place.
Did you dig up the whole thing and start over?
The whole thing. We're planting buckwheat, not for the pretty white flowers, but to plow under and really make good soil, because I have so many rocks, you see. And next summer, if all goes well, you better come out and see a nice velvet lawn.
this is early, though, isn't it, to do that in August?
It's either late or early, depending on what crops you plant to plow under.
Oh, the cover crop is buckwheat.
The plowing under kind, yes, mm-hmm, that's right.
Mm-hmm,
first
mm-hmm.
time in my life I've ever plowed under or caused to be plowed under. That's rather exciting.
I'll bet the place does look like one of your own industrial photographs.
Yes, I was surprised yesterday, because my place isn't so large. But this is kind of almost like an oval room out of doors and surrounded by woods. But there were three giant pieces of machinery there, just the sort I used to see in Algiers after the North African landing. You know, they put it on an airport and make one in a hurry.
And the kind of pictures you used to take out all through the Middle West,
right,
and the Far West.
That's
of,
right.
Of dams being built. And
I must assure you that I didn't photograph the work in my yard, because I never take a busman's holiday.
You never do?
Never do, no. It just kills me if people ask me to pick up a camera during my leave of absence time. You see, I've been working on a book, and I go back to active shooting at Life next week, and then I'll suddenly change to my other character. I don't know which is Mr. Hyde and which is Dr. Jekyll.
But you don't wander around the oval living room outdoors and take pictures?
I don't. Whenever I have an extremely beautiful batch of kittens, that's enough of an inducement, so I can drag out a camera and photograph them, but it stops right there.
Do you often have a nice batch of new kittens?
Oh, yes. And recently, we had the two... Do you want to hear about them?
Yes, I want to know about the kittens.
I love kitties. We had the two most beautiful kittens I've ever known, and they've been sent to Cleveland to my two young nephews, who are about to visit the mother cat at my home this weekend. That sounds a little complicated. But I love... this is probably a kind of cat you never heard of. I'm in love with Maine Coon cats. Do you know what they are?
Maine Coon cat.
Well, they're our only Native American long-haired cat. It's like a sort of poor man's Persian. They're just farm cats. They can't be bought. And you can only get them in Maine and New Hampshire and Vermont, because they like cold climates. The theory is that the early sailors brought over cats like this from Turkey. And when I was in Turkey myself, I could see cats just roaming the villages that were like this. So that could be true. They have faces like raccoons. That's why they're called coon cats. But they're so intelligent, Martha. They're like dogs. My kitties take long walks with me at night. And so recently, my nephews had a cat I'd given them earlier, which unfortunately got run over. And I was overjoyed when practically the next day, Memorial Day, these two lovely kittens were born, and their mother was so stylishly slender, I couldn't believe she was going to have kittens. And Martha, you'd never guess where she had them.
In your bed?
Not quite, almost. Under my chaise longue, but she had them on top of a pile of Life magazines. I had poked under them. Very slippery perch, you know, for the kiddies. So now they're about 2.5 months, 3 months, and they were sent air express to Cleveland a few weeks ago. My nephews just love them.
Do you have dogs?
I still have the mama.
Do you have dogs, too?
No, I don't. I'm a cat woman. Uh-huh. Now, the world is divided into two classes. Uh-huh. I'm not anti-dog, but I'm so pro-cat that there's no room for a dog.
Well, I like cats, too. But, of course, we have both because we have children.
Well, that makes it quite different.
We have everything. You know.
In fact, there's a big boxer in Cleveland, Harvey, 12 years old, and the kiddies are getting along with him fine. And when they first arrived, my brother and sister-in-law told me that they started spitting at the dog, but real spit. My brother got out his movie camera. And you see, for him, it's not a busman's holiday, and photographed them.
We just have one cat now, an enormous yellow cat. He's half Persian and half, well, anything. But he has long hair.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a kind of a pale yellow, almost a... he's really more platinum than gold. Pretty. And he's about the size of a small Cocker Spaniel. One of the biggest cats
enormous.
I ever saw. When he walks across the yard, people stop their cars
enormous.
To see what that thing is. He's so big. But he's a lovely cat.
How old is he?
Well, let me see. The children got him when they were 5. He must be about 8.
That's quite old. I've never kept a cat that long. Because things happen, you know. They get into fights, and it's sad, but... and more come, and you love the new ones just as much as you did the old.
Margaret Burkwhite, I wanted to congratulate you on, I don't really know how to do this, whether to congratulate the editors of Life, to congratulate the publisher of the book, or to congratulate you as being the first person talked, the first photographer described in the book, and the first ones whose pictures are shown. But anyway, I have on the table, as you know, the book, Life Photographers, Their Careers and Favorite Pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And I was delighted that the editors of Life put you number one in the book.
Well, that's very sweet.
And but it's understandable. You did the first cover...
Yes.
Ever done for the first issue of
That's
Life
right.
magazine.
That's right. And the first lead story, the dancers at the Fort Peck Dam are the opening wedge in the first lead, photo essay, we call it.
You might tell our listeners what the photograph of the first cover was.
Well, the first cover, Harry Lou sent me out to do a series of dams. This is before Life was even printed. We were just, we didn't have a name yet. We were just dreaming it up.
1936?
And in the fall of 30. Yes, in the fall of 36.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Or it was shortly before the magazine came out, 6 weeks before, let's say.
Uh-huh.
And I went first to Fort Peck and photographed the dam for the cover. Well, that is, photographed it, and they made it into a cover, which pleased me, of course. And then there was so much exciting frontier life, to which none of us knew about until I arrived and saw it. And, you know, this little bustling town, just it looked a little like the Warner's back lot, you know, where you have just the fronts of stores and houses, and in the back there's nothing. Mm-hmm. It was a little bit like that. It was so very primitive. And there were several bars, of course, all over the place. There was one where the barmaid was a young mother, and her baby was seated on the bar, which, of course, I photographed. And it aroused a lot of controversy when the story came out. But at any rate, I sent in that batch of stuff, and... got back an excited telegram from the editors who had decided to make it the lead story. And I have to admit, I'm very pleased about it.
Yeah, the first cover and the first lead story in Life.
Yes.
And you've done, you probably have lost track of number of assignments, number of pictures, and have
Once
kept no record
while,
at all.
I have to look up things. And the drawer at Life with our card index is so crammed full that I give it up and just sort of cook it up out of my memory. It shocks me, Martha, I've taken so many pictures.
But hundreds and hundreds of assignments.
Yes, ever so many.
And dozens of pictures on each one.
About a year ago, Life got together a traveling exhibition of my work and beautifully ran some of the pictures 4 by 6 feet. And it opened at the George Eastman House in Rochester and was traveling. And just getting
that
exhibit
together. I know,
because
you invited me to go up, and I intended to go.
I've had a special train, you know, for guests. It would have been so nice. Well, at any rate, in making the selections, I found that at Life, somewhere in the inner recesses of the building, which no one ever sees, there was a filing room of negatives, and I think all but a couple of drawers were mine, but this whole long, narrow room, like the hallway leading into the studio, and when you think that it was not just one negative in the front of each drawer, you know, that would still be allowed, but when you think of it in depth, It appalls me. Somebody should stop me. Nobody should let me. A single person takes so many photographs.
How many cameras do you take on each assignment?
If it's overseas, I take 8. If it's domestic, I would take at least 4.
Mm-hmm. You never go on any assignment with less than 4?
Probably not. And I would have at least 2 miniature cameras hanging around my neck if it was an active situation, one with a wide-angle lens and one with long focus, just so I could work quickly, because changing lenses takes longer than picking up the other camera. I'd have at least 1 Rolleiflex, which I love, but its uses are somewhat limited, and it takes a long time to load it, relatively speaking, so I might have 2 so that they were ready, or for replacements in case I smashed one of them. Then if there was any...
Have you ever?
Oh, often.
Do you
last
often
time
smash
I smashed,
a camera?
Not often. The last time was done in Elegance in Honduras when I was covering the Jesuit priests, and my mule acted up. He knew he wanted to get rid of me, and he ran very neatly right under an orange tree, which he could clear and I couldn't, you see. He was very efficient about it. So I sailed off and landed on my Rolleiflex, and that was pretty hopeless after that, and I think it's the funniest claim that the insurance company ever settled, which they did cheerfully. A Rolleiflex broken by falling from a mule.
How do they... I thought I read a couple of things in the book, Life Photographers, Their Careers and Favorite Pictures, about sort of the behind-the-scenes mechanics of all this picture-taking business. And I understand that each of you,
yes,
life photographer, owns his own cameras.
That's right. It has to be that way because we... cameras are a very individual thing, you see. It's like you picking out an overstuffed living room suite if you wanted one. You'd want to pick it yourself.
Uh-huh.
And you probably wouldn't pick an overstuffed one. But it's the same thing with cameras.
You pick out
things that you're interested in and want to use, then you trade it in on something else, or something new comes out and you try it out. But life also has quite a reservoir of specialized equipment, which we all draw on. For example, I own 2 airplane cameras, but I might need 4, and I draw 2 from life. Or the boys who take pictures with these fantastically long lenses, you know, of sports. I've never looked into the situation, but I'm sure that life owns the biggest ones. The boys probably own some of the others.
Mm-hmm.
But life is extremely generous in helping us with repairs and new equipment.
And insurance.
And insurance, yes.
Somebody told me that. Life carries the insurance on all of your equipment,
yes,
for all of
right.
you.
Yeah. The only time they didn't was the time when I was doing the helicopter story and the Navy dropped me in Chesapeake Bay. And there, 4 cameras went to the bottom of the bay. 2 were mine and were insured. 2 were life's and weren't insured. But life was so glad that I got out of it alive. I don't think they minded the loss of the cameras.
Margaret Burkwhite, the pictures that are shown in this layout about you, a wonderful picture of 2 gold miners in South Africa.
Well,
and I think you told somebody that was one of your favorite pictures.
Yes, it is, Martha. That's truly a favorite picture. Well, of course, the South African story was a great story to work on, you know. It was a privilege to be able to work on it. And it seems very opportune when we think of difficulties we're having in America over the racial question. And there, of course, it's a very bitter thing. And the black man doesn't have much chance to get an education. Sometimes he does, where missionaries help him, but usually not. So I tried to trace the whole story. And these particular miners I saw on a Sunday when they were doing native dances above ground. And, you know, wonderful, and their native costumes, and they dance unbelievably in a very exciting way. So I picked out these 2 and went to the mine superintendent and asked if I could follow them through a whole day of work. And he consented, and then he looked up to see the place where they were working and found this is the deepest mine in the world, Marion. It goes straight 2 miles underground. And
the
under
gold
the,
mine.
The gold mine. Under the city of Johannesburg, and I mean down perpendicularly, not laterally.
2 full miles.
And these men were working near the bottom in what they call a remnant area, which has already been very honeycombed by taking out a great deal of the gold. So the superintendent said, we don't take visitors there. And
Especially women.
He left that part of it off, but I guess it was in his mind. He said, we'll move them up to a more convenient level. So I said, Life magazine doesn't do that things that way. We photograph the real thing or not at all. So they let me do it, which I thought was fine.
They let you go down?
I went down close to 2 miles.
In one of those elevator things?
2 elevators. You take one, the big elevator goes down 1 mile. Then you step out and you get into a small slanting contraption that by slow stages, goes. You think you're never going to get there. It goes down the last mile. Of course, there's air near the passages. They pump that in as well as they can. But when you begin going laterally underground and then get to these sloping pits where the men work, well, it's hot enough so that your photographer who's seated opposite you almost passed out with heat prostration. And I just finished my pictures. I knew something was happening to me. I didn't know what. And I knew I was sort of moving in slow motion. And I kept thinking, oh, I'd like to come back tomorrow. And then I thought, if I ask for that permission, I'll never get it again. I better finish. So when I finished the last shot, the superintendent noticed that things weren't so well with me. And he led me off to a passage where there was a little more air. And, of course, I came to it once.
But the miners, the men you were photographing, stay down there all day.
No, they stay down all day. They come up and they sleep behind barbed wire. And I have photographed that, too. Lying side by side, rolled up in their blankets like sausages in cement buildings with no light or very little light, nothing to do but go to sleep, on shelves and on the floor. I've never seen anything like it. It's the way you'd pack Vienna sausages in a pan. They're fed well, but of course anybody who works so hard has to have the food. They're not exactly, it isn't exactly prison labor, but it's close enough so that it's hard to have a free choice. It's pretty hard for them to pick any other profession because they don't have the freedom of movement that the white man has. You see, they have to have special passes if they're going to walk down the road at night. So it's terribly controlled. And, of course, these men come from their own native provinces. And the fact that the young manpower is always drained off of the gold mines means that the soil runs down terribly. And they're allowed to go back, well, it depends on their contract, usually once every year and a half for 6 months. But they have to walk part of the way home, so that chisels into their vacation time a great deal. They're taken to the nearest railhead, and then they walk. And they go home, presumably, to breed more miners, and then they come back on the job again.
Margaret Burkwhite, do the young men in these tribes have any choice, or does somebody say, now you will work in the gold mine?
Actually, they have no choice, but it's set up so that it looks as though they had. It all depends on their taxes. First of all, they have to carry their tax receipt at all times. Imagine you and me doing that. And they have to pay their taxes in money. Well, they have an agricultural economy. You know, you normally would expect them to pay it in cattle or eggs or butter.
Yeah.
But they have to earn money to pay their taxes from the age of 18 on. So then they have to get their tax receipt, which they can show to the police every time the police ask for it. Then they're called in for the gold mine deal. The contract is read aloud to them, how literate they are, and if it's read fast, whether they can understand it, or whether it's read in their dialect, I'm not able to say, but the form is maintained. Then they sign their name, or sign an X, and then they get a number, which they wear, it's often tattooed on their arm, and from then on they're known by that number. And the real trick in making them go where they're needed for this sort of work is the pass system, you see. They have to have about 8 passes. After they have their tax receipt, they have to have a pass to travel. They have to have what's called a special if they're going to stay out at night. They have to have a pass to qualify them to look for a job. They have to have a pass when they get that job. And then if they don't like the work and want to move on, well, they'd have to get the pass, which they wouldn't get if they were still needed in the mines. They'd get it maybe if they were needed on some other sort of job, then they'd get a pass for that place. So by the time you've tied yourself up in knots with 8 to 12 passes, and you aren't very literate anyway, and there are laws against teaching you a skilled occupation when it comes to building, because they have to have a permit for that, of course. When it comes to building, the black man can carry the bricks for the white man, but he can't set those bricks.
He can't be taught bricklaying
because that's a skilled trade. And his best hope is to get into a mission school, if he ever heard of one, because the missionaries there really try to help things a lot and sometimes find brilliant ones and make it possible for them to go to college and come to America even, and go to college and go back. But, of course, this is terribly rare, I suppose, one person in a million or 500,000 who get such a privilege.
Mm-hmm. So with all of this, they eventually end up working in the gold mines.
That's right.
And sleeping in the barracks.
Exactly.
Behind barbed wire.
Or perhaps working in the diamond mines, which is
worse.
The same. And there, you know the expression you hear so often in this country about Negroes, although I must say we're progressing, you don't hear it so much anymore. But people used to blame lack of education on the Negroes, you know, and they'd say they were lazy and they couldn't learn anything anyway. Exactly those same remarks that you hear in Africa about the Negro native. And it did my heart good when I visited the diamond mines on the Northwest African coast, and I found that things were somewhat better there because it was an above-ground job, a special kind of job. But there was still the barbed wire. But I found that in the evenings, there were a few native diamond miners who had been taught in a mission school. And in the evenings, they taught the others to read and write and add and subtract. So here was certainly an example of the native miners, you know, really trying to help each other and help themselves.
I've talked to a few people who've come back, who've lived there, and who've come back, who present the you might say the other side, the side that you and I disagree with.
Yes,
and they use the same cliches that you hear in this country among people who don't want Negroes to have an equal chance with the rest of the citizens. The
now
same
of course,
old things.
You do meet people who, such as?
Well, such as what you just said, and then also saying, well, these things take time. We must wait for evolution
gradually.
And stop the revolution, you know.
Gradually, I know. Now, of course, you do find people with white skins in South Africa who are trying very hard to help the Negro.
Of course, as you do
Payton, as you do here, but it's a hard task because they're just so bound in, you see, and not having a chance to vote, and or it's such a restricted chance it doesn't really add up to anything.
Also, they're being exploited.
Well, it's too bad to use a word like that, but there certainly is no question about this.
What it amounts to is that the gold mine and diamond mine owners are getting very cheap, almost free labor.
Yes, exactly.
Isn't it?
Certainly. Which they feed well because you'd feed a horse or cow.